Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It took over 4 years for social media companies like Facebook and Twitter to take action on Donald Trump's lies and dangerous rhetoric. After inciting the insurrection at the Capitol, Twitter permanently banned him. A day later, Facebook and Instagram suspended him. Other platforms, including Amazon-owned Twitch, disabled his channel, and Shopify took down at least 2 online stores affiliated with Trump. YouTube, Snapchat, PayPal, TikTok, Reddit, Stripe, and Discord have also taken similar actions. And once Trump was banned, social media platforms saw a 73% drop in election misinformation, according to Signal Labs. That is 73%. So why has it taken so long to regulate big tech? What regulations and standards are needed to hold these companies accountable? And what do you think should be done to prevent the spread of dangerous misinformation online? Joining us to talk about this are 2 guests. Ramesh Srinivasan is professor at UCLA's Department of Information Studies and founder of the UCLA Digital Cultures Lab, which explores how culture and community shape the ways in which technology is used and understood around the world. His most recent book is called Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. Hi, Ramesh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. It's so nice to join you this morning and very happy to be joined also by my friend Deepayan.
Well, thank you so much. Great to have you. And we are joined by Deepayan Ghosh, co-director of the Digital Platforms and Democracy Project at the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and faculty at Harvard Law School. He is the author of Terms of Disservice, How Silicon Valley is Destructive by Design. He previously worked at Facebook, where he led strategic efforts to address privacy and security issues, and he was a technology and economic policy advisor at the White House during the Obama administration. Hi, Deepayan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rose, for having me. And again, also really delighted to be here with Ramesh.
Well, I want to ask both of you just how you're thinking about these issues right now, because these companies, you know, Facebook especially, are multi-billion dollar corporations. They have an impact on billions of lives around the world. And there's so many questions that are raised right now. You know, how much power do these companies have? How much power should they have? What about the free speech issues around this? And, you know, what will it really take to prevent the spread of misinformation online? So there's many questions to really talk about here. And Ramesh, I just wonder how you're really thinking about these issues right now, given where we are.
Yeah, I think, Rose, given the way you just framed those questions, it reveals how incredibly broad and pervasive the role is of different technology platforms on pretty much every aspect of our lives. So we can think of Facebook, for example, as an exception to a sort of dominant trend. But in reality, I think of pretty much every aspect of our lives, our economic lives, our personal lives, our political lives, are mediated by different types of big technology platforms. So I think it's important not to exceptionalize Facebook despite its numerous transgressions over recent years, but to understand that technology platforms or so-called big tech does not exist solely within the silo of technology itself. Every technology company has basically disrupted, I mean, that's the term they gladly use, pretty much every other aspect of our lives. I mean, think about the biggest accommodation provider in the history of the world, the biggest taxi company in the history of the world, the biggest media company in the history of the world, that's Facebook, the biggest retail company in the history of the world, that's Amazon, right? So I think it's important to understand that these technology platforms that are private and self-serving and equity focused for their investors are, you know, by their very definition, focused on their own interests. And as a result, the rest of us are more or less subjects of hidden and opaque decisions that they are making in relation to their own investors and executive decisions. So I think that's what the much larger challenge is that is at hand. I know that sounds almost unfathomable to try to deal with, but that's why we need transparency and some sort of good faith, you know, collaboration and regulatory action, in my
opinion. Right. Dipayan, what would you add?
Well, I think Ramesh is has very eloquently put together a set of observations and assertions that are all correct about the impact that that companies like Facebook and Amazon have on our public discourse, our path, our democratic path today and in the way forward, and our economic circumstances, not just in the United States but around the world. And to his point, many of the things that we see, many of the things that we do, everything that we're exposed to in the media, particularly over the internet, of course, is defined not by a public interest, is not defined by nor by by our own interest in finding certain things, but rather what companies like Facebook want us to see. And of course, the one objective that is driving Facebook to help us to try to figure out what we want to see is profit maximization. And it begs the question, how did we get here? How did we arrive at this circumstance where, as Ramesh has alluded to, Facebook dominates social media, Amazon dominates e-commerce, Google dominates search, internet search. And similarly, you know, one of these three companies dominates in email and web-based text messaging and online video and every other kind of component of the consumer internet industry, which, you know, individually taken or altogether are tremendously economically and socially important in the context of the United States, for instance, today. How did we get here? We got here because we are in a time where we're experiencing a series of technological trends where exponentially we're seeing increases in the capacity to store lots of data, to process lots of information, and to connect with people around the world through the internet. And this is all driven, of course, by the miniaturization of chips. But what this has meant is that there has been we somehow at some point passed a threshold, maybe 15, 20 years ago, where all of a sudden it became possible and in fact cost effective and rational in an open capitalistic system that we have in the U.S. to develop exactly the kind of exploitative business model that a Facebook or a Google or an Amazon have today, which is all focused on collecting as much information about us as possible and manipulating our experience in the profit interest. And something needs to be done about that. We need to rejigger the incentive regime here through regulation.
It's incredible when you look at the effect this ban had on social media platforms. Once Donald Trump was banned, the platform saw a 73% drop in election misinformation, according to Signal Labs. And then these headlines are just wild. From Business Insider, Facebook sees a $34 billion erasure from market cap as Trump ban out continues to spook tech investors, $34 billion. And then Yahoo reported that Twitter's ban on Trump could wipe out as much as 10% in profits. I mean, Ramesh, to Dipayan's point about the fact that these companies really operate under, you know, it's the definition of capitalism, profit at any cost. I mean, this headline about Facebook is just incredible to look at how much money they could potentially lose because of Trump being banned. But then the drop in election misinformation is also incredible.
Well, because our former President Trump, I'm very happy to say, was sort of the agent in charge of where we've seen the internet go, which is, you know, the internet internet systems are optimized for selecting and this is these are computational predictions, for selecting content that is likely to grab your attention. I mean, we're talking about multi-dimensional matrix algebra at play, where there are predictions being made around whose content and what kinds of content are going to keep people online, are going to keep people on the platform. Because the more attention, it's just like a television channel, right? The more attention, the more, you know, the more you are on a given channel, or the more you are on YouTube or Facebook or what have you, the more data that can be extracted from you, and the more you can be put into a feedback loop that can impact your not only your economic and consumer choices, but also your behavior more broadly. So we're talking about, you know, walled in behavioral, you know, almost B.F. Skinner like feedback loops that we're talking about here. So the, and President Trump is an outstanding example of how to do a type of messaging and meme like content with, you know, all of his like, you know, two word or three word kinds of phrases, you know, like fake news or what have you, that gets people's attention. So you can see the incredible symbiosis between the direction, as Deep Ayan was just saying, that our technology platforms have taken us. And it's really, again, it's not just technology. It's technology as the layer of mediation that has impacted pretty much every aspect of our political, economic, social, and intimate lives. So you can see that at play, how the incredible symbiosis. And to be quite frank, President Trump was a fantastic ally on an economic level to Twitter, to Facebook. We've seen many examples of how the kind of fringe right has been able to normalize and extend itself and almost institutionalize itself, partly by building support online. And it's not at all surprising that there would be massive revenue losses. I think this was a PR move, personally, that the platforms took at a very late stage. I do believe very much in free speech, but this idea of free speech as some sort of universalist, you know, kind of concept, when people who are vulnerable are being harmed thanks to violent speech and hate speech, I think is an extremely important point. I just want to mention a couple other very quick things, because Deep Ayan brought up so many important points. First of all, it's really important to note that the internet originally, I'm not saying the internet, you know, of the past is exactly the same, it's far from it, as it is today. But the internet upon which all these technology systems live was publicly funded. It was funded by United States taxpayers. In fact, the first node of the internet is very close to my office at UCLA. So just like our roads, the internet was publicly funded, which means anything that lives on top of public subsidies that is solely, you know, creating profit and valuation for private entities needs to be publicly accountable. You can't privatize all the profits and socialize all the costs. And the other just sort of point that I want to make is it's not just profitability, it's also valuation and equity portfolio valuation. A company like Uber, you know, biggest taxi company in the history of the world, they like to call themselves a technology company, but they're a they're the biggest taxi company and soon to be transportation company in the history of the world. They lose money every single quarter. And they even disclosed that that was part of their business strategy in their SEC reporting. Yet their valuation keeps increasing. So what we're actually seeing is a zombification, I believe, of various forms of capitalism. It's kind of no longer simply about profitability, though it very much is in many of the cases that Deep Ayan was pointing out.
I'm glad you made that point, because I've been wanting to do a show about this, that these companies that lose so much money every quarter go public and create a ton of millionaires overnight that has drastic effects on a place like the Bay Area, for example.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And think about, as we sit through this brutal pandemic, you know, how are we communicating? We're all communicating almost completely through private technology platforms. Look at the massive transference of wealth that has occurred during the past year or so. There has been an incredible transference of wealth to, you know, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, obviously Jeff Bezos, you know, the usual suspects, all the while we see brutal, you know, economic conditions and suffering for, I would say, the 99%, and definitely working people and racial minorities, gender minorities, etc. you know?
Right.
So so technology is amplifying the economic inequalities and injustices that exist within our society, not because of technology itself, but because, as Deepayan has written about in his book, the terms of disservice by which they are written.
To that point, the New York Times had a piece called Big Tech Continues Its Surge Ahead of the Rest of the Economy. And they report that in the third quarter of last year, Amazon, Apple, Alphabet and Facebook combined generated a net profit of $38 billion. Ramesh, just quickly, one more question. You say that you believe that what Facebook and Twitter did by banning Trump was basically a PR move. What do you think they're planning to do from here? We should point out we did invite both of these companies, but they never come on our show. We invite them pretty regularly, but they just don't come on. So what do you think their plans are from here?
That's a really good question. I think President Trump was a particularly exceptional egregious, quote unquote, bad actor. I mean, that's often a term you hear within the tech world, more or less we're doing things the right way. We have some internal deliberations. We have this council of advisors who are helping us. Note that all of this is being decided by them and not by a third party that actually is responsible for the public interest, like the government or the state. So I think Trump was sort of in the, eventually, what can you do, right? When it's very direct, when he's very directly connected to, a right-wing white supremacist, incredible, right? Takeover of the Capitol. Mm. I mean, what do you do, right? So they had no choice but to kick him off. But at the same time, I think it's really important to note that they were going after WikiLeaks. They've gone after a number of human rights activists, meaning not going after, but they've deplatformed them, right? This is long before Trump. So I think the point being that they are making decisions based upon their own calculations that navigate, I think, the multiple parameters of public relations, visibility, long-term economic sustainability and finances, because I don't think keeping a toxic figure like Trump being a dominant player on the platform forever is necessarily the best idea. But I don't doubt that possibly Trump will be back on these platforms. I mean, I'm curious what Deepayan has to say about it. And, there are folks who are in many ways not quite as visible, but even more extremist in their views that are on the platforms. My point being that I'm not against, these platforms hosting figures across the political spectrum, including figures who might be white supremacists. But the point being that the platforms are optimized and designed for the maximum visibility and virality of these types of folks. And that's why increasingly we've seen technology platforms aid, what was once a fringe kind of racist right wing turn into the dominant, the power of the Republican Party.
And we should also add that last week, the New York Times reported that Twitter removed 70,000 QAnon accounts. So Deepayan, what would you add to what Ramesh said? And what are your thoughts about what's next for these companies?
Yeah, even that statistic of Twitter having removed 70,000 QAnon accounts, or, Facebook often reports that it has suppressed millions of instances of hateful conduct. Those numbers are kind of drawn out of a black box, and it's very very difficult to understand, whether there were other forms of content, other accounts that might have escaped these platforms' review. And we need better transparency, to Ramesh's earlier point. I think looking at Trump's the case of Trump's removal from Twitter and Facebook of it on a temporary basis pending the oversight board's review, what we can understand from the former president's behavior is that he played off of social media to many of the points Ramesh was raising a few minutes ago. He knew that inciting his base would create this aura about himself that would maintain his popularity with that 38% that is immovable. He knows exactly which words to use at which times on what issues to really engage his core base. Furthermore, he took advantage of the kind of system that we live in today, particularly over Twitter, knowing well that at least while he was president and pending the election, he would receive public figure protection as the most perhaps powerful man in the world, and that companies like Twitter and Facebook would inevitably have a pressure to enable free expression, particularly of the sitting U.S. president. Of course, the calculus behind that decision inverted soon after the election, and particularly after the Capitol building attacks. But I would point out one thing with regard to Twitter and Facebook, which is that I would actually look upon Facebook's decisions. I would distinguish, first of all, Twitter's and Facebook's approach to Trump, and suggest that Twitter has acted time and again in democratic interest, or at least more democratic interest than Facebook. There are multiple examples of this from over the past 18 months or so, which this really started with, for instance, Mark Zuckerberg's speech at Georgetown on free speech, where he said that even if politicians lie on my platform through advertising, I'm not going to do anything about it. Whereas Jack Dorsey, a couple of days later, responded by saying that my platform is going to ban all political ads because we cannot assure that we can prevent the disinformation problem from taking effect over that platform. And so Twitter made a big commitment going back to late 2019, these events. And jumping forward now to the Capitol building events, what we can observe is that immediately after things got very heavy and hot on Capitol Hill, Twitter took offline content that Trump had put out pertaining to the events at the Capitol building. That was the first action from any company, and that barrier was the biggest barrier for any company. So what I'd suggest is that was the biggest and hardest decision to make for any company. Immediately after that, you know, an hour and a half after that, Facebook also took off content. But that was a much easier decision, to Ramesh's point, than Twitter's initial one. Then we saw Twitter act again. It suspended Trump's account for 12 hours. Only after that did Facebook say, okay, we're suspending Trump's account temporarily as well. And then Twitter, of course, suspended expelled the president from its platform permanently. And Facebook then took what I see cynically as a very commercially minded approach, which was to say that we are going to indefinitely ban Trump's account and refer that decision to the oversight board. Now, this is a really cynical take, but I believe it's the correct one. I look very cynically on the referral to the board, because analyzing this problem domestically, it makes sense to deplatform Trump. Analyzing this situation globally, and of course, the oversight board is a globally represented board with relatively little relatively appropriate American representation, it makes sense to perhaps actually keep Trump online. And Facebook knows that. Mark Zuckerberg knows that very well. And I think the board will have tremendous pressure on itself to reverse Facebook's quote-unquote decision to ban Trump and allow him to come back onto the platform because of what the board perceives as an important precedent that it will set for itself. Why does Trump coming back to the platform matter to Facebook? Well, you said it, Rose, just a few minutes ago, that, of course, disinformation and misinformation has come down, as Zignal's study shows. But in addition to that, all of that content leads to engagement, and having Trump online will enable Facebook to maintain a lot of borderline content that's going to be tremendously engaging. It won't raise regulatory ire from congressional Republicans and conservatives in America. It will not tick off President Trump's following, which is very important commercially speaking to Facebook. They engage on Facebook quite a lot, and it won't potentially lead to a slippery slope of regulation, content regulation from governments around the world. I really think that we need to be thinking about this problem more in through the sort of lens that Ramesh has presented, that he used the words that that these companies are privatizing all the profits and socializing all the costs. That's exactly what is happening through a business model of collecting lots of data, wielding that data in exploitative ways, and engaging in exploitative platform growth tactics that have showered negative externalities on our democracy. That's why we saw the events that we saw at the Capitol building.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today on Your Call, we are talking about the regulations and standards that are needed to hold these companies accountable, and what will it take to prevent the spread of lies and misinformation online. Deepayan Ghosh is co-director of the Digital Platforms and Democracy Project at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and faculty at Harvard Law School. Ramesh Srinivasan is professor at UCLA's Department of Information Studies and founder of the UCLA Digital Cultures Lab. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on our roundtable tomorrow, we will talk about Trump's American Carnage. It's a new Frontline documentary that traces Trump's presidential campaign, his appeal to white nationalists, the lies that we're talking about on today's show, and how that all led to a mob attack on the Capitol. And then we will discuss President Biden's task force to reunite separated immigrant families. And we'll talk about the plight of thousands of asylum seekers who are trying to get to the United States. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about what it will take to regulate big tech, what it will take to prevent the spread of dangerous misinformation online, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Or if you use Twitter, you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Today, we're joined by Deepayan Ghosh, who's author of Terms of Disservice, How Silicon Valley is Destructive by Design, and Ramesh Srinivasan, who's author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. I want to ask you both also about just where we are right now when it comes to the spread of misinformation and lies, because I was a tech reporter way back in the day when the internet was first really booming. And back then, the big story was about privacy, privacy, privacy. And then it sort of turned into, you know, how can we as citizens control our information rather than these companies making so much money off of it? Now, those two issues are still important. But this issue of massive lies and misinformation was not as big back then. And this is one that I really think about and grapple with as a journalist. There's a new study out, not that new, a couple of months old, by CivicQS. It's C-I-V-I-Q-S. It found that a third of Republicans believe QAnon theories. That's a third. I mean, that's a big chunk of the Republican Party. And so can you both talk about how misinformation and lies actually spread online? I mean, there was an interesting study out of MIT, and it looked at how on Twitter, false news travels much faster than true stories. It just takes off. So Ramesh, can you just talk about this and how do we grapple with this and deal with this?
Yeah. I love this question, Rose. Well, I think first and foremost, you know, before kind of diving into the technology and media components of this, I think we need to understand the conditions that have led many people to kind of rapidly move toward conspiracy theories, which have dominantly taken on a political formation, almost institutionalized on the right wing. The left has always had conspiracy theories as well, but they've been less necessarily directed at vilifying particular people, right? And so many people in the United States and around the world, right, with the gross amounts of inequality and economic injustice that exists in our country, you know, three people with equivalent wealth to almost 200 million people, right? And those numbers have gotten even worse, as I alluded to earlier, with this pandemic, which has, you know, marginalized the already existing already vulnerable, those who are already marginalized. So there are conditions of alienation that people are experiencing. And as a social scientist, I think it's really important to kind of look at that. What happens when people feel like, hey, you know, I'm part of this country, but this country, for whatever reason, is not compensating me correctly. I'm not getting healthcare. I'm not getting education. I'm not receiving a living wage. You know, as a progressive, these are things that are extremely important, not just to me, but I believe the overall health of our society. Deepayan used the brilliant term externalities, which means, you know, sort of what are the sort of effects of a particular transaction or a particular decision? What are the spillover effects? So these kinds of decisions that are being made to support, you know, oligarchs and billionaires, and particularly in the tech space, which are, you know, again, the wealthiest people in this country at this point, more or less, are decisions that are alienating and dehumanizing many people. Now, of course, many people have taken a hideous bait of racism and white supremacy that has existed in this country for, you know, since its founding, right? And that has been like catnip for some people. And that is partly why I think, you know, sort of theories like the QAnon theory, right, sex trafficking and child pornography and all of this can go viral. But now let's talk about the mechanisms, which is the question you actually asked me, which is really important, which is, you know, I think what we're seeing occur, and this is a beautiful thing about the internet in many ways, is the internet, you know, we have our own sites and spaces and forums, you know, Reddits and subreddits, or, you know, various websites that, you know, where we can discuss ideas with different folks. So there's a fragmentation that's occurred on the internet where there are many different sites, many different spaces for us to go to. And in those spaces, there tends to be a certain type of social psychology or normalizing bias where you go on a subreddit that's dedicated to, you know, a conspiracy theory like Pizzagate. And everybody on that site will not only echo maybe your own existing view, but actually have a hardened or more amplified version of that view, right? So that actually is like being in a room with thousands of other people who say the same thing as what you might think, but perhaps say it in an even more hardcore way. So that ends up reinforcing or even hardening your viewpoints. So that's one component of it, the exacerbation of a particular type of psychological or sociological or political viewpoint on a given space. But here's the key point. is what I would call the media ecology, which is the ability for content, and this is something Deepayan I know has analyzed quite a bit, for something to start on a subreddit or on 4chan or on 8chan or on, you know, some other like even dark website, right? And to spread like wildfire across different technology platforms. That's the media ecology. We've seen numerous examples. I remember when there was the mass shooting in Las Vegas, you know, which seems like old history now. And the conspiracy theory that shooter was a Hillary Clinton supporter and a Rachel Maddow show viewer went viral, not on the sites that it originally started on, some sort of bulletin board, if you will, but on Twitter, on Google News, and on other, obviously on Facebook as well. So how does that happen is because content moves across different kinds of technology platforms and based on these predictions of virality, right? So that's how the fringe, the hateful, can amplify across different platforms. So I think that is a huge part of the issue here. And that is part of what we need on a regulatory level, because people need to understand why they are seeing what they're seeing and what about them is being collected, known, and targeted. So I'll stop with that.
Yeah. You know, you make so many good points. And Deepayan, just listening to Ramesh reminded me of a piece I heard on NPR a couple of weeks ago, a very sad piece about how family members are losing their moms, dads, brothers to these different websites and these different platforms, where dad comes home and he spends 6 hours on some of these sites and gets sucked in. Or, you know, the mom is just not talking to her kids anymore because of this. And it also goes to a point where GQ had a piece in May by Luke Darby, and he looked at Facebook's internal research. And in 2016, they found that 64% of all extremist group joins are due to recommendation tools. So for people who are not on Facebook, I constantly am getting these invites to join different groups, or that it pops up on Facebook based on what I click on, join this group. And so that's really important to point out. And then it looks like just this morning or yesterday, Facebook announced that it will stop recommending political groups permanently. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think, this really comes to your question, Rose, about privacy. I think there actually is when we talk about consumer privacy and the disinformation problem, we're talking about one and the same issue in many ways. You said it, that 64% of all extremist group joins are because of internal recommendations, the algorithmic preferencing of Facebook's recommendation system. And of course, we know that the YouTube recommendation engine operates in a similar way based on consumers' preferences and beliefs. As well as those of other social media platforms. What is the connection here? And this is something that people like Ramesh and myself have been arguing for some time, that there is a connection. Part of Facebook's business model is to hoover up as much information about the individual user as possible. Why? It's to develop a behavioral profile on that person. Facebook collects information on us through so many different means, on-platform engagement, off-platform engagement, third-party web cookies, browser history, our mobile phones, location data, data brokers, you name it. They're collecting all that information, and they've set up systems, they've set up a digital infrastructure, if you will, to basically vacuum up that information about us on a personal basis, and analyze what it means. That's to say, take the raw data in its raw format and process that into a behavioral profile that their algorithms can understand, a profile that tells Facebook, you know, what is Deepayan's or Ramesh's or Rose's, what are their personal beliefs, interests, preferences, likes, dislikes, routines, behaviors, and so on. Now, it uses that information not only to target ads at us, not only to tell us what hair products and television shows to watch, but also to figure out how to rank the organic content, the content in our newsfeed, and how to recommend particular groups to us. And of course, this is happening not just on Facebook, but again, on other social media platforms as well. And when we are, you know, operating in a relatively unregulated space of open capitalism, this is only what makes sense for a company like Facebook or YouTube or Twitter to do. If these companies don't recommend the most relevant content to us based on our behavioral profile, then they won't be able to compete with the next social media platform. Of course, I do believe that each of these, particularly Facebook, is a dominant monopoly in its own sense, and so we've reached a stage where we need to intervene in different ways through our competition policy enforcement regime in the U.S. But back to the connection between privacy and disinformation here, it is counter to privacy for counter to consumer privacy for these companies to hoover up information without our knowledge. You think about the typical Facebook user, and we're talking about people from all social classes, not just in the United States, of course, but around the world. We're blinded if we actually believe that every the majority of Facebook users even understands the way that data is being collected on them and how the algorithms are tweaking manipulating their experience of the media. That is happening, and that is a privacy issue. That's to say, Facebook uses our personal data, often without our full understanding, usually without our full understanding, to inject content, to present content to us that it believes will engage with. And much of that content is misinforming, disinforming, hateful, inciting to violence. It's various forms of offending content that is basically socially unacceptable in a market like the United States. So there is a strong connection here. You know, you could ask, well, if we did have a strong privacy law, something like the European General Data Protection Regulation, which were enforced to the T, would this situation change? And I believe it would. You know, companies like Facebook would have a much harder time developing those behavioral profiles on us, and correspondingly would have a much harder time injecting the most minute-to-minute engaging content, including disinformation, at us. And of course, if we wanted Facebook to develop that kind of behavioral profile, we could opt into that. But I believe most people would actually opt out of it. And if we gave consumers that agency, that autonomy, I think it would reset the way that the whole digital media ecosystem works.
To your point, I want to play a quick clip from the documentary, The Social Dilemma, which looks at the human impact of social networking. And in this clip, you'll hear a variety of people just really talking about how companies like Facebook use algorithms to then choose the content that they want you to see. So you might see completely different content from your neighbor. Here's a clip from the documentary, The Social Dilemma.
Google and type in climate change is, you're going to see different results depending on where you live. In certain cities, you're going to see it autocomplete with climate change is a hoax. In other cases, you're going to see climate change is causing the destruction of nature. And that's a function not of what the truth is about climate change, but about where you happen to be Googling from and the particular things that Google knows about your interests.
Even two friends who are so close to each other, who have almost the exact same set of friends. They think, you know, I'm going to news feeds on Facebook, I'll see the exact same set of updates. But it's not like that at all. They see completely different worlds because they're based on these computers calculating what's perfect for each of them.
The way to think about it is it's 2.7 billion Truman shows. Each person has their own reality with their own facts.
Why do you think that Truman has never come close to discovering the true nature of his world until now?
We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
Over time, you have the false sense that everyone agrees with you because everyone in your newsfeed sounds just like you. And that once you're in that state, it turns out you're easily manipulated, the same way you would be manipulated by a magician. Magician shows you a card trick and says, pick a card, any card. What you don't realize was that they've done a setup. So you pick the card they want you to pick. And that's how Facebook works. Facebook sits there and says, hey, you pick your friends, you pick the links that you follow. But that's all nonsense. Just like the magician, Facebook is in charge of your newsfeed.
We all simply are operating on a different set of facts. When that happens at scale, you're no longer able to reckon with or even consume information that contradicts with that worldview that you've created. That means we aren't actually being objective, constructive individuals.
And then you look over at the other side. And you start to think, how can those people be so stupid? Look at all of this information that I'm constantly seeing. How are they not seeing that same information? And the answer is, they're not seeing that same information.
And that is a clip from the documentary, The Social Dilemma. We just got an email from Ed who wanted us to talk about this issue, actually. And he writes, I think a step forward while still preserving free speech would be for the platforms to stop using algorithms this way for political and social speech. Show everybody everything and we'll all be better off. How can you convince these companies to do this? How do you regulate it? I don't know, but I do know that living in an echo chamber does not do anybody any good. What are your thoughts on this, Ramesh?
I mean, that's for sure. And I appreciate Ed's comment. I mean, to be in a democracy, you need to have some space where you can be aware of and have the opportunity or ability to have dialogue with those with whom you may disagree. You can't live in a set of sort of alternate worlds that are more or less opaque and insulated from one another, where you think that the worldview that you share with others online is the worldview, is the right. That creates the demonization of others and the vilification of others. And so, you know, every democratic society needs some sort of baseline, not only a baseline of fact based on facts and evidence that recognizes, you know, conditions of alienation and a lot of the hypocrisies of elites, like I was talking about earlier, that have alienated people, but you need to have the ability to have dialogue and visibility with those with whom you may disagree, because actually many of our disagreements are not nearly as severe as they seem when we go online. And by the way, this is not merely an issue online, though tech platforms have absolutely amplified and accelerated these issues due to points that Deepayan was just making. But this has also, this builds upon the fragmentation of our televisual media, right? Like, you know, if I'm sort of a mainstream DNC person, maybe I'll be on MSNBC all day. You know, maybe I'm, you know, or I'll find another sort of television channel that confirms my existing viewpoints in many ways. And so this is an issue that also has to do with elite media itself and the choices that elite media networks, you know, including ones that I've been on, you know, God bless them. But still, you know, I mean, they have particular agendas and particular stories that they want to share. That, you know, I think of Noam Chomsky's famous Manufacturing Consent, you know, from 30 plus years ago, where he talks about the agendas of those in power driving media industries. So I think that, you know, Deepayan made many outstanding points there. I think they're really important. And I think just one other thing I want to add on to that is that our data are not just being grabbed when we are on Facebook or on YouTube or on any single platform, but they're being grabbed from us by those companies, even if we've never created an account with them, even if we are not online actively using those. And as well, I can buy all of Deepayan's data or your data, Rose, and I can aggregate that data. I can buy your credit card data, or I can buy other sorts of data from you, which is not allowable under the GDPR, the European Union regulations that Deepayan spoke to. And what I can do is I can cross-aggregate that data. So Rose, maybe you present yourself as a public figure, as a journalist in a certain way on Facebook, and I can harvest and scrape all that data. And I can even harvest data about you from, you know, in a way that you're not even aware of from Facebook. But what if I also had access to everything you bought and sold or at least you bought with your credit card records. That might present a different kind of portrait of you. And if I am able to aggregate those different data points, I can create a far more invasive and behaviorally manipulative portrait of you that can be used to steer you and manipulate you in certain ways. And that is exactly, by the way, what Cambridge Analytica did. They are an example of where we are heading, you know, more and more and more if we continue down this path. Mm.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and we'd love to have you both back. Once we learn more about the Biden administration and how they plan to deal with this, but you wrote a piece about this, Deepayan. What will tech regulation look like in the Biden era? What are your thoughts so far?
Well, I think we're well positioned to see really aggressive intervention, and I hope we will. We know, of course, that the Democrats have taken both the Senate and the House, and of course, have the presidency now as well. And I think we're seeing several signs already of both kind of the external, the circumstances external to the federal government, as well as the intrigue and interest within the federal government that suggests that both the political circumstances and the economic situation we have at hand point to really aggressive regulation. And that where are we going to see that? I think in areas touching the business models of these companies directly. So I'm thinking of privacy, of transparency, competition policy, and as well as kind of the again negative externalities or the negative social output exhaust of these companies, as Ramesh has put it as well, and so perhaps in Section 230 reform.
Deepayan Ghosh is co-director of the Digital Platforms and Democracy Project at the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and faculty at Harvard Law School. He's author of Terms of Disservice, How Silicon Valley is Destructive by Design. Deepayan, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you. And thank you, Rose. And thanks, Ramesh.
Thank you.
Great to join you.
And Ramesh Srinivasan is professor at UCLA's Department of Information Studies and author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. Ramesh, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it was great to join you. This was such a fun conversation with my friend Deepayan too, so I loved it.
Well, thank you, and we'll definitely have you back to continue the conversation. And thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for engineering our show. And I hope you can join us tomorrow. We will talk about a new Frontline documentary called Trump's American Carnage. It looks at his presidential campaign, his appeal to white nationalists, and how it led to a mob attack on the Capitol. And then we will talk about President Biden's task force to reunite separated immigrant families. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.